Welcome to Office Hour for today. This is Professor Jay, otherwise known as Naomi Janowitz. And as always, on Tuesday afternoon at 5 o'clock, we knock on someone's door. What are all these people doing hidden away in their offices in these buildings all across the University of California? And we're taking a special trip today, and we're going away from UC Davis, and we're interviewing someone from one of our sister campuses, something we've done before on this show. And I'm really happy today to have with us Jonathan Simon from the Berkeley Law School, Bolt Hall. So welcome to the show, Jonathan.
Well, thank you, Professor Jay. Thanks for having me.
Yes. And we're going to talk today about incarceration. And I have a personal stake in this issue, which I think is of great interest to many of you listeners, which is that I was involved in starting a college program at San Quentin. So I went many times and passed through the gates of the portals into San Quentin and got to know some of the inmates when we developed the college program. And I've often thought about that, the difference between what it seemed like on the outside and then going in and actually getting to know some prisoners. So we're going to be talking about that today. Now, but as always, before we start to talk about the particular research, we always ask our guest how they became interested in this particular area. How do you wake up one day and say, ah, I want to find out what's going on in the deepest, darkest prisons of California? What led you to this area, Jonathan?
So I, like a lot of things in a lot of people's lives, it was a combination of greatly intentional action and completely unintended or accidental events happening. So the intentional part is I was an undergraduate here at Cal, and I began as a political science major, but I quickly was drawn to more philosophy, political theory and philosophy. The rest of political science was a little too dry for me. So I was reading especially a lot of existentialism and phenomenology with Bert Dreyfus, who was a great instructor on this campus for many years, passed on a couple of years ago now. In any event, reading that, I also then had an accidental encounter with going to jail, getting arrested during protest activity on the Berkeley campus. And like many existentialist philosophers before me, I found in jail a sort of fascinating universal or at least modern political dilemma. What does it mean to keep people under captivity, and what is that about, right? So this sort of fascinating philosophical question about humanity and the jail. In fact, there was a sign in the place where we were fed saying prisoners are to remain silent during feeding. And I remember thinking, just kind of from a kind of Wittgensteinian point of view, like a world where you get fed is not a world where your human rights are, you know, very valued, clearly. So it was fascinated by, you know, the problem of punishment and the prison. And so I decided to kind of pursue that into graduate school. The double accidental part is that on my watch, as it were, as I got onto that question, I bumped into an independent trend that I had nothing to do with starting and certainly couldn't stop, which was this rise of incarceration, which I didn't know was going on as I set out to sort of study the dilemmas of punishment.
How did you run into it?
I ran into it because my dissertation advisor, who was another sociologist who I'm sure knew Morris Janowitz and probably told me to buy that book because I was studying social control, and he theorized that quite a bit. But Shelley had studied the California prison system and its population dynamics for many years, and he was quite aware that the population was rising. Mm-hmm. And he was also aware that the parole system, which is the back door of corrections where people who have been released from prison are supposed to get both help and supervision while they're in the community for a few years, rather than being a back door, it was becoming a sort of recycling chute that sent people, sent people back to prison. So he wanted me to study that, find out what was happening, got me access to the Department of Corrections Parole Division, and set me on my course there. So in a way, the dissertation I wrote and the book I wrote, not to sound too conceited about it, I mean, it was kind of one of the first sociological studies to sort of describe the dynamics we now call mass incarceration, although it didn't use that term, which David Garland would invent about it
a little bit
later.
Right. So it was an interesting confluence between a personal experience of going to prison. I don't know if we should encourage our students to get arrested.
I think everyone should go once.
Once, okay.
To jail.
Maybe get arrested for... I often tell my students, if they're going to get arrested for something important, not for a minor driving violation, but for something like a protest. That, and then a combination of that and mentorship, that you had somebody who really clicked you into an area that really was meaningful to you.
Very important.
Terrific. Okay, so then you write in your book about several important law cases. So really following your path is one of following law and some fairly technical issues, I would say, about legal cases and plaintiffs and what gets decided in favor of whom. Before we go into the particulars of the cases, you argue that it was these law cases began to undermine the presumed moral foundation of mass incarceration. So what you're saying is that law was a mechanism for kind of revealing inhumanity. And I'm just curious, do you think that's generally true? I mean, again, as students think and they launch themselves out into the world, are you saying that law is a way you can see into other parts of the world that there's no other way to see into, and that's why it's important? Would you make that argument? Or is it just a fluke? Or what do you think about that question?
That's a great way of putting it, because, you know, in extreme cases, and this was one, I mean, that's precisely what law in perhaps its most valued moments can do. I mean, what this ancient legal writ we call in the common law world habeas corpus, which is Latin for produce the body, but which it technically allows courts to demand of jailers of all kinds the reasons why they're holding particular individuals, and essentially to allow those reasons to be tested in some instances, is a great example of it. I mean, here I think you had a confluence of a number of things. One is that prison, and maybe it's one of its ancient and modern purposes, by its very nature, keeps sights unseen. We don't know what happens there until we suddenly are brought to there by a terrible events, in the case of a riot or other kinds of disasters, or in this case, a man-made disaster, human-made disaster of overcrowding, illness, psychological degradation. So prisons are always that way. In contemporary society, they become even more so. That's part of the story of how California's prisons became so degrading, is that they were located very far away from big cities where there might have been experts or other people that could keep more of an eye on them. The system became very hostile to outsiders at a time when I was in graduate school. That was sort of the turning point. Before that, the California Department of Corrections had been a relatively progressive prison system that welcomed academic and other interventions, and so it would have been easier for people to know what was going on. So the point is, by the early 2000s, and one of the things that motivated me to write the book is, we thought we knew a lot about the number of people in prison, but we knew very little about what prison was really like. Mm-hmm. It had been decades since prisoners had been able to, you know, write memoirs that were widely distributed like they were in the late 60s, or that sociologists were allowed to write ethnographies that describe what prisons like they had frequently. So there was a problem of invisibility. Mm-hmm. So that's one aspect of it. But the other aspect is, it's not just what we see, but what we allow ourselves to recognize. And I think one of the things I saw that motivated me to write the book is that courts had played a sort of a significant role of omission in allowing mass incarceration to become normalized. That is, they might have played a role of calling out mass incarceration earlier on and saying, yes, the state can set whatever sentences it wants, but you're not allowed to treat people in ways that are going to reliably, predictably produce degrading conditions, torturous conditions even. And they hadn't. This case was dramatic because it punctuated a long period of silence from the Supreme Court, and that had also allowed the lower courts to fall into silence in many respects.
But it's interesting way you talk about the courts, as if somehow the courts was a personified, you know, what you're saying is that the people didn't use the courts to uncover more or to litigate more against the rise in the prison population. So maybe on the one hand, you've made two. Is that what
people tried to? But I think, you know, first of all, the law shifted pretty dramatically by both the Supreme Court and by Congress in ways that made it harder. So the Supreme Court, in a case that I don't think I discuss except in passing in the book, because it's a footnote to the case we're dealing with here. But the court decided that overcrowding by itself was not a cruel and unusual punishment. Okay. That was back in the early 1980s. And that was an important moment because had they actually said, wait, this is America. If you're going to have prisons, they can't be overcrowded, even if it's not creating terrible conditions.
Okay.
There would have been no mass incarceration, period. But that didn't happen. More importantly, they decided a number of cases, and then the Congress stepped in with the Prison Litigation Reform Act, which made it dramatically harder for prisoners to bring lawsuits. And there's dramatic data collected by Professor Margot Schlanger of the University of Michigan Law School that just shows, you know, the rapid drop-off in what had been a pretty robust number of cases in the 70s and 80s, and then the 90s come along.
Well, I think that's a really helpful clarification. I think that makes it clearer what we're talking about then, because what you're saying is that the courts are obviously interconnected here with other forces in society. On the one hand, the courts themselves were saying it's okay to overcrowd, and then other forces in society were also pushing for the overcrowding. So as a result of this kind of confluence of different factors, what you talk about is this 500% increase in incarceration in California from 1977 to 1998. So that's really an amazing statistic. So I think if you could help us understand a little bit, what were the social forces that led to such a dramatic increase in a state that we think of in some ways as being much more, as you said, much more on the forefronts of rehabilitation?
So I think, California is one state in a 50-state nation that it, all of whom moved in the direction of more incarceration in this period, some at greater rates than others. One thing to note is that the only cluster of states that grew more rapidly than California by the end of that period was in the Deep South, and an area that had traditionally been more punitive than the rest of the country and more racially driven in its punitiveness. California, paradoxically, was one of the more lenient states in the country, regions really, if you compare it to other regions at the beginning of this period. So we go through a change quite unlike almost any other states. And I think I put it in the book that, you know, we become the Mississippi in a way of mass incarceration. Mississippi in the era of segregation was the state that did it so badly and so awfully and so brutally that almost even the most unwoke white people could sort of recognize that Mississippi was in a bad way. And I think California became that. And that's shocking for mass incarceration.
Shocking.
And it's shocking because unlike Mississippi, which can at least blame its poverty and lack of education for some of its problems, we have neither of those excuses in California. So what did drive it? I think here it was, and I talk about this in my second chapter, which focuses on the 70s. The 70s, which is when I came to California toward the end of that decade, and I thought it was a wonderful place to be. And it, you know, coming from the south side of Chicago, it certainly didn't look scary to me. But what you have to understand is that the state and the country had gone through a 20-year unbroken period of rising homicide rates,
right,
and violent crime. And California both had a lot of it, and because of its hypermedia climate, it was more surrounded by it. We had more higher profile incidents, like if you think about the Tate-LaBianca murders at the beginning of the 70s, the end of the 60s, kind of set the moment for that. I think, you know, LA to this day is the source of most incarceration in California. In some ways, you could argue that mass incarceration in California was an aftermath of Manson. At least Manson was a signal example of the kind of events that made people feel massively insecure in California.
Serial killers.
And I talk about them in the book. I mean, at one point, there were so many serial killers running around the state that they had a third freeway killer. Now, the media dubs these folks. I don't think they get to name themselves. But
yes.
You can imagine how pissed off the first one was, like, after doing all that to get famous. So there was a lot of scary people. And the other thing is California, if you think about it, in the Earl Warren era and the Pat Brown era that kind of preceded this, was the state most embracing of what you could think of as sort of modernist, scientifically oriented, welfare-oriented governmental programs designed to solve social problems, lift up people. The University of California system is an exhibit of that once strong vision that has faded to some extent, but that's a different story, different discussion. And when it came to those institutions, I mean, that's where a lot of the hope for handling violent crime and problems like that had been placed. Mental health, rehabilitation in prison, more scientific use of policing. By the 70s, people had lost faith in all of those things quite dramatically. And in some ways, social science you know, help to confirm their worst fears about them, social science being an imperfect form of study of the world in any event, and certainly in these cases, not very helpful. So I think part of it really is a world where people are faced with a lot of fear. It's certainly, we can talk about the racial construction of that fear, because that was a very important part of it. But the tools of modern risk management had suddenly come to seem unavailing, and prison looked like a kind of a
solution.
A solution that it was simple,
pretty
and
good
brutal.
One. Just put them all away there, and we all feel better. I mean, you think about the kidnapped kids on the milk cartons, and I think also the emphasis on genetics, that people are determined genetically to be, you know, bad people, and that kind of notion there. So we've got the image of the serial killer. You also mentioned, and let me clarify that the book that Jonathan is referring to is Mass Incarceration on Trial from the New Press. So you can all pick that up and read it and go into detail on these law cases. So we've got the image of the evil criminal. We also have the riot, as you talk about Attica, the famous idea of the prisoners are going to be out of control even when they're in prison, so you have to keep making it more secure. I love that you brought in the witch, because that comes into my area of study. Mm-hmm. And certainly one thing we've seen is the power of the idea of the witch and how difficult it is. It's almost impossible to prove that someone is not a witch, with those famous Monty Python routines will show you. And so so I think that that also is very useful for us for thinking about just how these social fears get manifested in people and how difficult it is to fight against that. So we're going to take our first break now for a public service announcement, and we will be back for part two in just a second. Welcome back to Office Hour. This is Professor Jay, and today we're talking with Jonathan Simon about his book, Mass Incarceration on Trial. And at the end of the last segment, I was talking about the problem of the power of the witch and how difficult it is to really to fight against that image once it gets embedded in a cultural system. So did you have something you wanted to say about that?
Well, and you'd been mentioning the riots, too. And there was two major prison riots, one here in California at San Quentin that happened in August of 1971, and then the much more famous one that took place at Attica Prison in New York a few weeks later. And as I think many in your audience will know, Heather Thompson, the brilliant historian, has written just a fantastic book on that called Blood in the Water. And you got to, if you can track her down, she's in constant motion, get her on the show. But Attica, which was, in a sense, interlinked with what happened at San Quentin, both, I think, have brought together the fear of violence that was happening in American society with a new view of the prisoner as a kind of super strength version of everything that people feared behind violent crime. People who couldn't control their instincts or their desires, people who had lost any ability to be kind of regulated by the normal deterrents and attractions of everyday life. In other eras, we've thought of those people as witches. People have somehow gone off the grid of sort of human
superhero,
control.
Super bad powers.
Super bad powers. In our era, we came to see certainly young men of color in our big cities through the lens of high levels of violence in those places as being somehow super predators, as they would come to be called by the 90s. And among all of those scary racialized images, the prisoner, especially the black or Latino prisoner, came to sort of embody both this most unknowable and therefore, you know, potentially devastating risk, and something that we could do something about. That is, we've got these folks locked up. All we really need to do is keep them locked up. Or, and this is where we get to Madrid versus Gomez, because it became an intrinsic part of the system, not just keep more people locked up, but lock them down in a way that we've never done before in American correctional history.
Mm-hmm. If you think about the escape movies, that's one of the problems. We have escape movies in which the prisoner who escapes is somehow the hero. So we had that whole genre. But on the other hand, that opens up the possibility that the person who isn't the sweet, you know, person who deserves to get out, right? That those people, the bad people, are going to be getting out.
I mean, the escape movies are important because they're testimony of a day when we had a much more sympathetic view of prisoners, and which we saw them as ordinary Americans caught up in a terrible bureaucratic nightmare. And I think we could have that again. That's one reason I think movies are important.
But right now, we've got this, in this part of the story you're talking about right now, is a huge fear that not only are they bad, but we're not going to be able to isolate them.
And so let's talk about the what is called generically in America the supermax prison, or what we call in California the security housing unit. It epitomized in many ways the depth to which mass incarceration sort of took the American view of prisons, not just more people in prison, but in a form of prison that had been considered barbaric in the 19th century, essentially solitary confinement, isolation from normal kinds of programs like education or even work assignments that keep prisoners somewhat in a social framework that is more conventional. That represented not just a change in our view of prisoners, but the power also, and this is important in California's story, of correctional officers who play an interesting role here. They're kind of part of the larger public audience that increasingly has a horrified view of who prisoners are. But obviously they're front line, and they view themselves as the primary exposed victims. In the actual San Quentin uprising, several guards were killed by the prisoners, almost certainly. In the Attica uprising, many guards were killed, we now know, completely by the invading police and correctional
and
officers.
Not by the inmates.
Not by the inmates, but the opposite was said at the time.
Yes.
And so figures like George Jackson, the leader of the uprising at San Quentin, or other Black and Latino politically active prisoners came to typify to the correctional officers, you know, a huge threat, and also one that the public was, at least in their eyes, some of the public was unduly sympathetic to, especially politically left people like my family, who thought that Attica was, you know, an example of a oppressive state gone crazy, which was closer to the truth, but not what people understood it to be. So all over the country, these new prisons represented, I think, you know, the movement of the idea of the prisoner toward this witch-like, super predator-like figure, monstrous figure that needed this kind of lockdown environment that couldn't benefit from rehabilitation. And in California, reflecting how deep these fears were, we took it to a scale that no other state has come close to, building two gigantic prisons and keeping hundreds of prisoners for years. And indeed, until the case that falls outside of the book, because it happened only recently, we had over 200 prisoners that had been in for more than 10 years, which is a staggering amount.
So they're in this complete isolation, and they have very little, they're separated from each other, and they're in isolation cells. And as you talk in here, it's quite difficult to read. They're treated very badly, and all the issues we're going to talk about, they have no health care. Whatever mental illnesses they had will be exaggerated. So then we have this case, the first one that you're going to talk about, Madrid versus Gomez, where somebody said, this is inhumane treatment. And I'm just curious, before you talk about that case, why did we end up with a case being for the extreme prisons? Or is that just partly from the structure of you telling the book and not about what was going on? Because that was a small percentage, but yet the case was important, even if it was about what we would really think of as a fairly small percentage of the prisoners.
Well, and that's a good point. There had been a lot of litigation in California about prison conditions, including at San Quentin and Folsom, which had been the major high-security prisons. And I think what made Madrid distinctive and made this a novel kind of a lawsuit is that traditionally in the cases that had succeeded in getting courts to say, look, this is cruel and unusual punishment, you were generally dealing not just with problems like overcrowding, but with really archaic infrastructures, with really deplorable conditions, with really underfunded guard or correctional officer staffs, etc. Pelican Bay was supposed to be a state-of-the-art, high-tech prison, right? It was not supposed to be the kind of prison that was essentially subject to the sort of traditional Eighth Amendment claim that prison conditions had created torturous conditions.
If you walked through
it,
apart.
It was not falling apart. Right. It was still fresh,
brand new. That
brand new prison smell in some ways was still on it in 1990, the late 80s, if I have the dates correct, when the litigation began. What really drove that case then, the reason that the court ended up finding serious violations of the Eighth Amendment even though, and we'll come back to this, ultimately the great Judge Thelton Henderson, who began us on this path, very regretfully in his own voice, had to conclude that the prison, the whole idea of this kind of prison itself, wasn't a per se violation. He allowed it to be if it could be improved. But the two things that he really called out there that I thought became sort of the foundation for a lot of the subsequent cases in this focus on the inhumanity of our current form of imprisonment was, one, the extraordinary concentration of people with mental illnesses in a setting that was supposed to be designed for sort of the worst of the worst, the most aggressive, violent people, and was actually holding many people who were just radically decompensating and were getting bad. We're decompensating further in those conditions very rapidly. And then intertwined with that, taking a guard force that viewed the prisoners as basically gang leaders, potential threats to their security, and this alarming behavior that was actually being caused by mental illness, relied extensively on violence, basically, to manage what was supposed to be a high-tech prison. And that was kind of the irony, right? The prison had been built in part with this very pessimistic view that prisoners are monsters and we need to sort of a kind of Jurassic Park view of how you kind of handle prisoners. But with the idea that we're going to do this in a way that will be clean in the eyes of the courts because it won't rely on violence or cruelty. It'll be all technology. And here they were.
Bright lights and clean quarters.
Bright lights and very clean quarters, which of course added to the mental breakdown since often the sterility of the view from their cells was extraordinarily monotonous. But in any event, it was producing, they had to do cell extractions. They ended up doing the kind of medieval torture-like treatment of some prisoners, like the one example that I quote, unfortunately, from at length, and it's a very lengthy description in Judge Henderson's opinion, but of a severely mentally ill prisoner that was put in a scalding bath and basically his skin more or less scrubbed off of him.
Right. So what we see with this law case then is, interestingly enough, here in this extreme part of the prison with these smaller percentage of inmates, there is a stance made by the courts that this is cruel,
this is cruel and unusual
punishment. And so a line is drawn there in the sand, so to speak.
An initial line is drawn, and I think a warning is given that comes to fruition in the rest of the cases I tell, that if something isn't done to change the basic thinking about what imprisonment is for in California, that the line around protecting human dignity, which the courts had already said was part of the Eighth Amendment, could be breached. That, so in Madrid, to close it off, Judge Henderson ordered that people who were known to have a mental illness could not be held in those conditions, which, just to remind you, are conditions of basically of 23-hour-a-day lockdown.
Right.
And isolation from programming and many opportunities for visits, etc. And the court essentially demanded that new procedures be put in place to make sure that violence wasn't being relied on to sort of deal with all of these cases. Now, shockingly, you know, the state did not really take advantage of this signal to do anything about the problem of mental illness. They continued to remove people from Pelican Bay who were identified as mentally ill. But in other parts of the state prison system, which had a similar security housing unit regime, they continued to incarcerate mentally ill prisoners. And this is one of the dilemmas of litigation as a reform mechanism. Unlike legislation, which would affect the whole state, litigation tends to be prison by prison. That's
right.
Another thing that made Brown versus Plata the ultimate case so extraordinary is that the whole system was essentially caught up in one mega case.
So it's a limited tool.
It's a limited tool
to work with. But I'm curious whether you have, before we go on to the next case, which will move us into the general prison population, why do you think mental illness was sort of the first step in this, on this path? Do you think it's partly because it just was so flummoxed the guards? I mean, dealing with mentally ill people is difficult, and it's flummoxed the guards to such an extent that that was one of the places where you see the out-of-control seepage? Because I'm sure there are a lot of other cruel and unusual aspects, as we'll see later, to the prison. But this seems to be have been one of the tools that opened it up in some way.
Well, I think that the focus, I think in a way the mental illness component, I wouldn't say it necessarily surprised the lawyers involved, but I don't think it was the starting point necessarily for their attack on the case, which was more motivated by the sense that this was a new regime of imprisonment, much more severe than anyone had ever seen before. It was not just a system that wasn't going to rehabilitate people. It was something that looked almost like a high tech version of a dungeon, essentially, that would return us to almost a medieval approach. So I think the sense was, you know, in a time when the Eighth Amendment has still some force to it, we ought to see if we can, you know, at least condemn this aspect of mass incarceration. As they got into it, I think the record of the case demonstrated that much of the violence, et cetera, was, you know, tied up with the reaction of the staff to these severely mentally ill prisoners. And so I think that helped to open the door. I mean, to me, as I began to follow the arc of the case, and the reason I included Madrid, one of the reasons, even though it was not a linear part of the case that became the Supreme Court decision in Brown versus Plata, is that it was the first to sort of open the can and show us this sort of nest of related problems of mental illness, of this kind of hostile, warlike attitude toward prisoners that didn't allow guards to develop any kind of more humane strategies for mm-hmm. coping with some of their problems.
So then we move from there with Coleman versus Wilson. We move to a general question. We're now no longer in special Uber prisons. We're just in the general, the idea that just in general prisons are inhumane places because of the overcrowding.
And it was not overcrowding yet that was the major part of the frame. What Coleman focused on, and this is helps to fill out the discussion we were just having, it was essentially a parallel case to Madrid. It was decided within months of each other. They were launched by coalitions of lawyers that were closely aligned together. And it was Coleman that was taking on this already visible problem of mental illness. And again, one of the values of Coleman is that it became a measure. Just once it became a class action, and the class was prisoners in California prisons with a serious mental illness, you suddenly had a legal mechanism that actually forced the state to actually put a number. And this, one of the shocking things about Coleman was just for the court to reckon with what a high percentage of the prisoners as a whole. At that point, it was only in the neighborhood of 10 or 12 or 15%, but it's gotten higher since, it's closer to 30% today for a variety of reasons. But that was already shocking given the fact, and this is the focus of Coleman, that the prisons had been set up with no real capacity to deliver professional psychiatric or psychological therapeutic care.
The dungeons often aren't, right?
Dungeons often aren't, but these were prisons that almost all of which, and remember, we were in the middle of a big prison building boom to implement mass incarceration. This was after the federal courts had made many decisions in the 60s and 70s, making it quite clear that prisons actually had an obligation to provide needed medical care, including psychiatric care, to prisoners. So everything was understood here, but it was and that's one of the things that I think really stands out about the case, that it's, we believed our monster image so much that we really just didn't prioritize. I honestly think there was a kind of naivete. It's like, well, these are zombies. Zombies don't have psychiatric problems. They're dead, right? So they're just pure menace. So, you know, we can't treat them as individuals that actually have trajectories and life histories.
Mm-hmm. So, and then we come to the big case, Plata versus Davis, which I love that the chapter head there is called Torture on the Installment Plan. So, and here we move out from mental illness and the idea that mentally ill patients have a certain kind of right, that we move to just general health care, that prisoners have a right to have health care, and that is just part of unusual punishment. Now, in some ways, when you read that case, when I read that chapter, it didn't seem that surprising that prisoners would have a right to health care. And maybe this is what you were just talking about, that some things were just somehow not really conceptualized, that people didn't notice this, people hadn't planned on it. It seems like a pretty big oversight, doesn't it?
It is. And can we talk about it now, or should we do it right after the break?
Let's talk about it, and then we'll take a break.
Okay, that sounds good. So it was actually back in the 1970s that the Supreme Court had said prisons have an obligation to provide physical health care, even as in a case where they actually rejected the inmate's actual complaint, which is not untypical. Now, it's interesting because it was a time when courts were, under the Eighth Amendment, were putting a lot of demands on prisons to provide various levels of food and comfort, etc. This did not stand out as a particularly big problem, and it wasn't a big concern when California turned around in the 70s and decided to build a giant new prison system. They did not conceptualize healthcare delivery, putting aside the mental health problem that they were blind to, obviously, in the Coleman case. They just did not focus on it. We know it because the case goes into detail on just the lack of infrastructure. It's like when you're designing a prison, it's like designing any other building. You say, well, this is a closet. This is a, you know, if you're going to have clinical space, you've got to design that clinical space in there. And I think, so let's try to, in a sense, be create a sympathetic account. How could the state have been so stupid, naive? And I think it was a combination of things. One, this super predator view, right? Super predators don't age. Zombies don't age. Their life course is over for them. They're dead, right? But humans, even human, quote, criminals, unquote, are humans. They do change. And a part of that, sadly, as many of us experience in the life course, is greater propensity to illness and suffering that comes from physical disabilities as well as illnesses. So they were naive about who they were bringing in there. Secondly, traditionally, prisoners had been pretty healthy people. The modal prisoner in the 50s or 60s would have been a burglar or a robber of some, and those are demanding trades that require a reasonable level of physical fitness. They weren't drug addicts, by and large. They might have had drug problems, but that was not as central to the prison population as it became in the war on drugs, right? And that's the other side of it. We began to put more people in prison whose primary crime was being drug dependent and therefore part of a lifestyle that tended to go along with serious chronic illnesses like hepatitis, like diabetes, like HIV. And so we were doing, several things were coming together that nobody saw really clearly. We were assembling a prison population not of the scariest, toughest monsters in the state, but of some of the most medically vulnerable people in the state who had lots of potentially expensive chronic health problems that were going to go on. We were putting them in prisons that had been designed as if they were summer camps in terms of the level of medical care they were ready to provide. Like, everyone's healthy, they're going to need Band-Aids, etc. And this began to develop over time. We began to keep people in prison a lot longer.
That is
and clear. That began to have a big impact because prison time is, your body ages much faster than it does outside. And so when you spend 10, 20 years in prison, you become a much sicker, older person than you were.
And it's hard for us to imagine old people who are having like denture problems as being the prison population, but everything that comes with aging. So at this point, we turn to the happier part of the story, which is when the courts come in and they say, it's time for you to reduce the prison population. So what we'll do when we come back after the break is we'll talk about the improvement in the system and then where you see it going in the future. Welcome back to part three of Office Hour. And today we are talking with Jonathan Simon from UC Berkeley Law School about his book, Mass Incarceration on Trial. So we're right at the moment in the plot, the big turning moment in the plot, when the court orders a reduction in prison overpopulation, which you say is one of the major interventions of the court into a prison system, which otherwise is kind of moving on its own power.
So by the end of the 90s, basically, two different federal courts had defined the entire California prison system as in violation of the Eighth Amendment, both on grounds that it wasn't providing mental health care to those prisoners that needed it, and that it wasn't providing physical health care to presumably all prisoners that have a body who might need it if they get injured or stabbed, right? Which, you know, these are supposed to be dangerous places, so that's a very real possibility. This is where the cases become classically Dickensian. After these dramatic court orders, essentially years of grinded out hearings followed with very little, if any, evidence of progress. And that's where we see, again, some of the limits of litigation as a tool of reform and why what happened later became so important. Because what tends to happen is you win one victory, but the system views it as just a battle in a war. And so they lock down on the next line of contention, and they battle you on every aspect of that. And so nothing really gets done, and the resources tend to get absorbed by lawyers, which is not bad for my students, but it's probably not the best use of trying to solve these problems. So what got dramatic, though, is that in 2003, these lawyers all came back and they asked the federal courts involved to constitute a new kind of super court, which had been required under this Prison Litigation Reform Act, this 1996 law that was designed to and did make it much harder for prisoners to try to seek their rights in federal court. One of the ways it did that is it told federal courts, if you want to tell a state that there's a population cap, which is sort of the thing we most don't want you to do, because we believe in incarceration, you're going to have three judges agree on it, not just one, right? And so that was part of it. They had to convene the super court. And this court was asked to consider essentially the Prison Litigation Reform Act, again, trying to make it very hard for courts to do this, set these very strong conditions on any prison cap. You had to basically show that the prison population overcrowding was the main reason for the violations not being resolved. You had to show that there was no other way that would possibly solve that problem that didn't involve a population cap. And finally, even if those other things were true, you still had to show that the impact on public safety would not be too significant.
Right, that and letting so people out.
This was designed to be a set of tripwires that most judges would go, well, wait, I'm not going to say that some lady's not going to get mugged because of this. It's too, and that is what many of the dissenters on the Supreme Court said, that there'll be dead bodies essentially following. So that set up really one of the most dramatic, I think, litigation situations ever, and certainly for mass incarceration. It basically forced the court to consider not whether this or that particular condition was a violation of the Eighth Amendment, but whether this whole system of overpacking the prisons, and they went into detail on why that was happening, right? Things that I had written about back in my dissertation, like the fact that people on parole who committed rather minor violations
were put back in prison.
Were routinely sent back to prison, often for very short periods, but adding to what in some prisons was a 300% over occupancy, right? So this put, as I put it in the book, mass incarceration itself on trial in a certain sense. And when the court found for the prisoners, saying there's no way that you can resolve these underlying Eighth Amendment problems unless you bring the population down, and there's no way you can do that unless you at least consider some of these new policies that in effect would be something else than mass incarceration, you know, relying on probation and local jails rather than prison for low-level felonies, which is what the state, in a sense, did ultimately in the realignment law. So this was a dramatic moment. The state, you know, was given a gift in a way, a lengthy opinion by three very experienced and wise judges about essentially the best ways to reduce the prison population without leading to more crime. It was essentially a blueprint. And did the state seize it and run with it? No. They went to the Supreme Court and said, they can't make us do this. And that laid the groundwork in way I would have been critical of that decision, which I think was undertaken by then Attorney General Jerry Brown. But in a way, it's a gift to us because it forced the Supreme Court to then consider this and whether they would draw a line or not.
And that turned out to be useful because they did.
They did.
So it
and
was
by one vote.
By one vote.
The vote that we now miss very much, that of Justice Anthony Kennedy, who's, you know, and we should cheer here for a moment because we're Californians, and Kennedy is an offspring of this state, and I think if you look at his record here, he made some decisions about prisons back when he was on the Ninth Circuit that were quite good. He's always seen prisons as a potential area where human dignity, something that's very important to him, could fail.
So we can give him one cheer.
We
could at least give
him
one cheer.
Well, my wife, who's sitting at this table, described this book somewhat uncharitably as a love letter to Justice Kennedy.
Okay, so maybe we'll give him two cheers. And what happens is we're told that there are several different ideas implemented, one of them being that if people do rehab, they get credit for that, and that means they'll get out earlier. You talk about that. You say that some people should go to alternative programs and not go to prison in the first place. So that's another way of reducing the population. And also you talk about low-level felonies also not going to prison. So as you say, this was a pretty clear blueprint that was actually given and then implemented, if only unwillingly, but ultimately then implemented. And you say that there was a reduction from 156,000 to 120,000.
And it's continued to drop at least modestly below that now.
So what do you think it is now? What's your best guess?
I think it's getting close to 100,000. I think it's 100,000 and some change. Now, it's still overcrowded,
yes,
unfortunately. And as we haven't had a chance to discuss, but is in the book, attempting to comply with the Prison Litigation Reform Act's, you know, concern about public safety and the necessity of any population cap, the court set a population target of 137% of design capacity, which is, if you think about it, quite a high one. It means that, you know, I like to go through this with students because people don't really think about what does it mean to have 100%. You know, if you go to a really popular hotel, believe me, it's not 100% occupied because no hotel actually wants to operate with 100% occupancy. It's too stressful on even them. Right. And those are with people who want to be there. Right.
So, or think of a bathroom being 137% occupied. That'll do it pretty quickly. So what you say we need to do moving into the future is you have one very bold plan here, which is not really about a legal system. It was really, but is saying we should adopt the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, Article 5.1, no one shall be subjected to torture or to cruel, inhumane, or degrading treatment or punishment. So that's a very broad way of looking into the future because it doesn't even mention prisons, right? So this is now we're really out of law and we're into a social
change. Not out of law. We're out of domestic law and into something that we could call international human rights, which I think is law and it's very important part of law, and one that this country has never embraced as much as other parts of the world. And this is in an area where we could do that, right? Where we could decide that the experience of mass incarceration was such a profound loss of American values that we're going to signify in a public legal way our commitment to do better by putting something like this in place. And let me explain briefly why I would do it. And the reason I would do it is that historically, the Eighth Amendment and that language, which is in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, were viewed as being the same, as meaning the same. But in the era of mass incarceration, our courts interpreted the Eighth Amendment in narrower ways that have allowed prisons to really decline. Whereas in Europe, for instance, using very similar language in the European Convention on Human Rights, they have adopted the European prison rules, which are much more demanding than anything that we've talked about here in terms of making sure preventively that prisons don't become degrading places. Likewise, the United Nations now has something called the Nelson Mandela prison rules that provide really robust protections. And the reason this is so important is that we know from the Stanford prison experiment 40 years ago that even when you have the best possible, you know, material to make your guards and your prisoners out of, namely Stanford undergrads, and I hate to concede that they're the best, prisons drive degrading conditions very quickly because of the nature of the imprisonment function. And you need to have strong rules in place and you have strong monitoring in place. You can't rely on litigation to do that. And that's what we've done, ultimately, in this country.
But as you also kind of made the opposite argument, which you have showed that having a law is not enough. And that's what you've showed, that we have, or having this case, we have the amendment, and it's actually not enough. And it was easy for things to happen in the country that are bad, even if you have it. So maybe there's also part of the point is that the law and another law is not necessarily what you need to have. And I think that seems to me to be very important in your book, that one of the messages of your book is that law can be useful, but part of it is, could we call generally paying attention?
But I think it's dialectical, right? Sometimes we use law as a tool, a shield, we sometimes say, to protect us from an increasingly oppressive state, and it has limited effectiveness in that. But there are other moments. I would say the Civil Rights Act of 1964 is a good example where an achievement, a change in the political culture, which signifies something deeper than just the paper the law is written on, is being signaled by what's essentially we could think of it as a constitutional or constitutional-like promise to do better. Now, the neat thing about the U.S. is that we're states, right? And our state, because our state, as I said, became the Mississippi of mass incarceration, we could decide that we want to amend the California Constitution. And what it would do is be a signal to California's courts, look to Europe, look to the UN Convention to try to understand, and not to Mississippi.
So in this dialectic, what's the leading factor in the dialectic? Is it that at some moment you have a particularly brave set of judges? Is it a particular brave moment of social change? Where are we in that dialectic?
You know, I wish I could completely predict it, but I think we are at one of those moments where we see this at different moments in history. Values that have been developing for some time. And if you look at the 20th century around issues of war and human rights, I mean, people were talking about human rights and protecting populations from genocide after World War One, right?
Yeah,
before
sure.
we got to the Holocaust. They thought they had put some of that into the various kinds of conventions that they had created at the time. So what I think tends to happen is that you get this evolution of values, but those values are very easily checked. They get suspended. They're not so much they don't get so much refuted or renounced as we say, oh, we can't afford to honor those right now.
Right.
We're in a state of war. That's why we bombed German cities to the point where we knew that thousands of civilians were dying. We didn't want to take any more chances.
We're afraid.
That's when
we're afraid.
And we at those moments, we kind of recognize that we're not being our best selves as a collective. And I think one of the ways we do that is by saying, look, we're going to kind of suspend the Constitution. Actually, the infamous Weimar Constitution actually had a provision allowing it to be suspended by the president, which is what allowed Hitler to be appointed chancellor. So it can go wrong. But in our country, we have a softer version of it. The courts tend to not enforce the Constitution very strongly. Famously, in the Korematsu case, they decided, even after the fact, not to hold the federal government accountable for what was clearly a racist decision to intern Japanese. But what can happen is that in the aftermath of those moments, we feel kind of collective shame and we strengthen those underlying values. And I think one of the things that this case did, what tends to happen at these change moments, is that something happens to force the actual images of how awful human beings can be treated out into the public eye. We saw that with Abu Ghraib, right? Abu Ghraib was a dramatic moment. People were okay with even maybe a certain amount of torture, but they didn't want to do that, not clearly degrading stuff. When they're forced to see it, they said no. Even George Bush said that's not what we, you know, set out to do. And I think the images that came out of this case in some ways, not as dramatically, have helped to do that. They've helped to humanize prisoners as older people, as disabled people, as people who suffer from the same kinds of things that we do, like a knee that gets reconstructed and a correctional officer that forces you to walk on it up a flight of stairs, undoing all the surgery you just had. Those are things that almost anybody can experience. I was really fascinated by, and I talk about it in the book, this moment in the middle of the 19th century that led to the birth of the Red Cross, where this banker came upon the aftermath of a battle and saw the suffering of the wounded soldiers. In those years, European armies had no real provision for dealing with the wounded. They were pretty much just left to die where they lay with some local comfort possibly provided. And this guy wrote a book about it that sort of shocked the conscience of the European educated classes. And very quickly you got both the International Committee of the Red Cross and the Geneva Convention, which is our first statutory human right, basically a deliberate effort to construct a human right. And it's interesting that prisoners, like soldiers, you know, can be seen as enemies, can be seen as not us and therefore not human. But there are other moments we recognize, as we have in the Red Cross that and the Geneva Conventions, that even the enemy is a human being and we want to honor that somehow. And I think this is a moment where criminal justice could, you know, we had a war on crime. It went too far, very clearly. And now we can regret and also redress. And I think part of it is bringing human rights into our system. Part of it, though, has to be much more practical things like we've been doing in California, taking whole categories of crime off the table for prison, as we did with the realignment law, essentially forced by the courts, but I think doing the right thing.
That's not a prison. You're not going to go to prison for
that.
So
we need to do that. We clearly need to rethink how we use prison. It's not, you know, the model that we had in the era of mass incarceration was zombies are among us. We need to lock them up forever.
It turns out they're human beings.
They're human beings.
Right.
We've had dramatic drops in crime. Even the people that were in prison, when they come out, they have less crime than they did in an earlier cohort. So
we're turning away.
We're turning.
In a moment, and what a great note to end on. Then the dialectic goes from the legal case, it goes to the capacity of us to see other people as human beings, which is the very mushy end of the dialectic that we're in now, to see other people as human ends. So I just want to remind all our listeners that if you want to listen to this over again or you want to listen to some of our other archives, you can always go to officehourucdpodcast.com, and there will also be a link there to Jonathan Simon's website, and you can find more information about him. That's officehourucdpodcast.com, and thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was great fun. So we'll be back next week, and we'll knock on someone else's door. So goodbye from Office Hour.